Time for the Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:07 on Friday, January 24th. This hour, we'll look back at the top headlines in politics and hash the pros and cons with two guests from differing political perspectives. From Governor Walker's State of the State address to proposed changes to the Common Core education standards. There's a lot to cover this week. My guests today are John Sharpless, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
And we also have Joe Winicky. He is a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning to both of you.
Well, first, the governor outlined a number of tax proposals in his State of the State address this week, pointing to an estimated $911 million projected surplus as a reason for doing so. This is what he says should be done with part of that money.
These new revenues are not a one-time windfall or budget gimmick, but come from a strong economic recovery where more people are working, more employers are hiring, and personal income is going up. They also come from good stewardship of the taxpayers' money. What do you do with a surplus? You give it back to the people who earned it. It's your money.
Joe Winicky, should that money go back to the taxpayers?
Well, I mean, that's what's going to happen. A good governor, Tony Earle.
We're going back.
told me many times, I have great respect for Tony, and he said, good government is good politics. It didn't work that well, frankly, for Tony, even though he strongly believes that to this day. But it was the right thing. And sadly, in both political parties in this state and this country, the concept of good public policy is usually be damned, and let's do what's good to keep us reelected. And this was a political statement through and through. And the most amazing part, as he wants to... the centerpiece of this is to come up with a new gimmick on vocational and technical and adult education monies for supposedly a tax cut. The problem is, I know a little bit about taxes, and that property tax cut, if there is one, if it isn't eaten up by schools and cities and the like, will come out in December and the election's in November.
John, what about you?
First of all, I think the way you handle a surplus, and I understand the confidence that the governor has that this is not a one-time blip on the radar, but I think the sensible, conservative thing to do is to wait to see if these kinds of surpluses are generated over 2-3 years, and then look at a tax cut. At this point, I think there's two things to be done with the money. It should go a substantial portion, not just a token amount, into the rainy day fund, and we should pay down our debt, which is contributing to our structural deficit. That should be number one on the list. And there were some cuts in education that they partially met in their last time around, but our two-year colleges in the state, the state system, high schools and grade schools could use a bit more money. But most important, the rainy day fund in case of a crisis in the future. The notion that this is the last recession we're going to see is the silliest thing in the world.
And if I could add to that, John, the way that state government budgets, the numbers that they use to create their budget are actually created 30 months out. Nobody has a crystal ball to say what the economy is going to look like. What's happened here, there's been a small national uptick. According to the Fiscal Bureau, that's where the money came from. But there were also warning signs. Since Scott Walker has been governor, our general obligation debt has gone up by $1.2 billion. We have lost $120 million in Medicaid money. We have a $350 million transportation shortfall. And the list goes on. We also cut public education for K-12 schools by $1.6 billion. As you know, $310 million cut out of the university, which has only been about a quarter of which has been funded back, a 30% cut in technical school money. And in the meantime, he's increasing the structural deficit in this state to $825 million. So, I mean, ever since Scott Jensen, a blast from the past again, was Speaker of the Assembly, the Republican mantra in this state has been to freeze, is basically to starve the government by reducing revenue. And this budget does that too. And the fallacy of Governor Walker's proposal is it actually increases that structural deficit to over $825 million. Well, that guarantees, since that's the first $825 million, it has to be found in the next biennium, that we start that far in the hole, which means we can guarantee that we're going to starve government again in 2 years. And I don't think that's what people want. They want a government that works.
They also want continuity in the budget.
Yes, I agree.
I'm an old Republican. I do understand the mantra of lower taxes. I do understand the message that he said, this is your money. Of course, it's the money of the people of the state. And I think to be critical of Democrats, I think sometimes they forget that. But I think sound fiscal conservative policy calls for a bit of caution at this point with this surplus. It should be put into the bank account and paid down the debt. I just say this to the listeners across the state. Let's say at the end of the year you found that you had a couple thousand dollars more in your checking account than you anticipated. Would you quit your job? No. You'd say, I'm going to keep it there in case I need it in the future. It's almost as if we want to quit our job as governing in this state just because we ran a momentary surplus, which, as you pointed out, Joe, is not really a surplus because it doesn't account for the structural deficit.
And one quick point on that, John, is that there are things I generally agree with your synopsis of what you should do with the money, a little bit into education, a little bit in the rainy day fund. But I think some of that money, whether it went in the rainy day fund or, more importantly, would be to get rid of some of the accounting gimmicks that have been going on for years. I'll give you a classic example. K-12 school's fiscal year goes from July 1st to June 30th. We pay the last payment for school aides in July of the next fiscal year. If we brought that back into June like it used to be, you would free up that money in the future, reduce your structural deficit, and have the same effect as a rainy day fund, but now it would be permanently fixed. Mm-hmm. Until we fix these things, every governor, every legislature is going to have these problems.
Well, it's very hard with both the national accounting and the state accounting to know exactly who, what department has what money at what time. Any business person would go crazy with the way in which government is accounted for in this country.
Well, and some Senate Republicans have even expressed some concern over the long-term effect of handling the surplus this way. Here's Senator Dale Schultz.
People are telling me, balance the books. You know, we're not interested in something will help you guys get reelected. What we want is the books balanced.
We spoke with Representative Robin Voss yesterday, and he said the Assembly is fully behind Governor Walker's proposal. Will it pass, do you think?
Yes. By the way, that income tax cut amounts to $4.80 a month.
No, I
not even a six-pack of beer.
First, I've got a bias. I've got a bias. I've known Dale Schultz for two decades. He was one of a group of active people in politics who taught me how to stand on a stump and give a speech and introduce me to people all across this state. He's a great guy, and I really love the way in which he's critical on every issue. Sometimes he votes Republican. Sometimes he votes with the other side of the aisle. That's the kind of person you want in there. Will this pass? I think it may have some trouble in the Senate, but my guess is that the House will pretty much march lockstep with the governor. I don't think there is one Republican in the House that has had the courage over the past 3 years to buck the governor. Now, over in the Senate, a number of people have expressed on the Republican side concerns about the structural deficit. It may bog down over there. It'll be interesting to see in the final analysis whether Walker can crack the whip and bring them into his camp.
Yeah, I think you're largely right. What I think is going to happen is I have little or no respect for how the leadership of the Assembly Democratic Caucus functions. And what I think is going to happen is they're going to put in a couple amendments to do their fix, and then two-thirds of the Democrats are going to vote with the Republicans for whatever Walker does because they all think about the elections. In the Senate, I think Mike Ellis, Dale Schultz, Luther Olson, Rob Coles are onto something. I think you might see the income tax cut jettisoned, because that would take away the increase in the structural deficit, and then they can claim victory. It's almost identical in dollars. So I think you'll see some modest modification in the Senate, but it's going to pass.
Yeah, well, a while back I was at a meeting of conservative leaders in the state, and the governor was there, and we chatted a bit about tax cuts, and he told me that his goal was to entirely do away with the income tax at some point in the future. And that's a fascinating idea. Other states have done it. And I looked at him and said, well, how can you guarantee fiscal stability without an income tax? And he says, well, I think our state has there's the possibility that the sales tax might have to be raised as a trade-off. Now, Joe, that might be a good idea.
But it'd be 13%.
Well, what we would do is we would become more like Nevada and Florida, states that are driven by sales tax and by income.
But, John, why can they be driven by the sales tax? They're both big tourist states, gambling at Vegas and Florida's sunshine.
Well, people come here because it's 30 below zero, don't they?
21 below coming Monday night.
No, but I've given this little speech before on this show. We have a dial we can turn in this state. And at each point, there's a different tax. But if you turn it to one, that means if you cut down on one, one of the others have to go up. We've got a property tax, we've got an income tax, we've got a sales tax, and we've got a corporate tax. And the question always becomes, as you rotate that dial around and you try to decide which one is going to take the hit, one of the other ones suffers. We are clearly a state that will probably never do away with the property tax, which in some ways in a state like ours with farmers and people with small town houses and that sort of things is probably our most regressive tax.
It is.
The governor said that the average homeowner would see a tax break of about $150, including $44 to $58 reduction in income tax. Do you think that this will make any difference to taxpayers, and how would it affect Scott Walker on a re-election year?
I think nominally, if any, will it affect the election. I think what you've got here, as I mentioned before, it's about a $4.80 a month income tax cut. And say this, if you're going to do an income tax, at least he did it right. He reduced the lowest bracket instead of the highest bracket for once. Mm-hmm. So he did that part right. But the impact of $4 a month or some change isn't going to affect anybody. Mm-hmm. And the property tax cut, and they found this out last year when they did their supposed $100 million, the increases in other, you know, the five taxing jurisdictions, I mean, whether it's the county or the technical college or the school or the city, always eats up the other part, so nobody even knows they got it.
Joe, it's one more beer at the pub.
I don't go to the pub. I go. Okay, never mind.
Well, when you think about $4.50 only buys one beer. We've tried this before.
Not in Peoli.
That gets you two. We've tried this before. We run a surplus. Both Republican and Democrats have pulled this stunt, and they send you a check for $50 in the mail, and then a year and a half later, they announce there's a deficit. I think Americans should get tired of this. We need much more accounting stability. You spread the... And when you're in the moments of high returns, you save it for the rainy day ahead. You meet your debt obligations. Sending everybody $50 is not the way to solve the problems of this state.
Come on, John. You're being way too practical.
I'm being conservative.
And practical.
You're listening to The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. My guests this hour are John Sharpless, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Joe Winicky, a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. You're welcome to join the conversation as well with your insights as to the top headlines of this week. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We've been reflecting on the governor's State of the State address given this past Wednesday, and we're also taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. My guests are John Sharpless, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Joe Winicky, a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. This week, during the State of the State address, we did hear Governor Walker draw some contrast between him and his predecessor, Governor Doyle. Let's listen to one example.
During the 10 years before I took office, property taxes went up by 27%. Think about that. If property taxes had continued to grow at the pace they did during Governor Doyle's final term in office, the typical homeowner would have paid $680 more by the end of this term. It seems like a long time ago, but taxes went up $1.7 billion in Governor Doyle's last budget in 2009.
Joe Winicky, your response.
Boy, he wants to relive past history. Next thing you know, he's going to start bragging about his job numbers. You know, the what if taxes had gone up? Well, first of all, because of the deep recession we were in, nobody was going to be raising taxes at the amount he made. So he makes this huge hypothetical and then blames Jim Doyle. You know, eventually a strong leader should just take credit or blame for what they do. And I mean, what? Next thing I know, I'm going to go back and blame Tommy. I should for something, but I like Tommy. I mean, what? Come on, Governor. And you know, at least Jim Doyle, if I want to be nasty, he didn't introduce known sex offenders as heroes like this guy did the other night.
John Sharpless.
Well, taxes did go up under Doyle, but if you actually look at the taxes that were increased, and many Republicans voted for those increases, it was things like the cigarette tax.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that Walker wants to look at the state of Wisconsin and say, we're going to reduce the cigarette tax. It's interesting, the taxes that were increased under Doyle are not the taxes that Walker is asking to reduce now.
No, they're not.
That's fascinating to me. But that's ritual politics, right? The guy who came along before me was the devil. I'm Jesus Christ, and I'll lead you across the water. Joe, that's a ritual. Everybody does that. You know, I've saved the state from crashing on the rocks of fiscal disaster. I wish, as you do, that they would get that this ritual happens with Democrats in Washington now, with George Bush being the devil, and now they've resolved all the problems that were created by George Bush. And then, of course, under Bush, Clinton got blamed. We go around and around on this sort of thing. It doesn't. It's not useful. And what's most important is the context. I'm not a Doyle fan. I'm not at all. I could go on a rant about Doyle. I think he had a lot of problems as a governor. But he had a different time period in which to operate, and that's the real key. He had to make decisions that Walker didn't have to make. And Walker didn't have to make them because he had made them.
Yes.
He made the cuts. He's the guy that took the hit on the recession. Walker comes in after much of that had been done, and then he gets to prosper as the economy comes out. I'll give him, if you ride it out, if you're the guy that's in charge of the boat when it comes out of the storm, you get to walk around on the deck just as George Bush did and say we won the war.
As Bill Clinton did and as Tommy Thompson did. Tony Earle made all the tough cuts back in 84 and 85. Tommy Thompson came in at the beginning of the, you know, the internet bubble and everything else, and the economy got better. But I don't blame Tommy Thompson for that, nor do I blame Tony Earle. I mean, it's a product of what their times were. I mean, you're so right about that. And I'm just tired of this governor, 3 years after Jim Doyle has no longer been governor, just making him the bogeyman all the time. It just makes no sense.
It seems as though we'll hear more of his name throughout this election year. We had the vice chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Brian Schimming, on our program on Wednesday, and he drew comparisons linking together Jim Doyle and Mary Burke. Is this a theme we're going to see this year, and how will it affect Mary Burke's image in the voters' eyes, Joe Winicky?
Go ahead, John.
I love Brian Schimming. He is an old friend. But his job is, again, as a political advocate, to do those kinds of things. And Democrats in Washington did that with connecting Bush with Romney. You know, if you vote for Romney, you're going to get Bush. He's really Bush in disguise. That sort of thing goes on all the time. I know what Brian's doing. I'm not sure if it's going to work. I don't know if the people of Wisconsin have a level of I don't care for Doyle. We could make it. We could have a whole show on my complaining about Doyle. However, I don't think the state of Wisconsin shares the kind of grumpiness that Republicans have about Doyle. He's history. He really is. And there were lots of people in the state who thought he was an okay governor.
He never lost an election. I mean, I would not make my whipping post on an election cycle, a guy who had never lost an election before. It makes no sense whatsoever. And, you know, Mary Burke's her own person. And, yeah, you know, Mary Burke did work as Commerce Secretary under Jim Doyle. They also like to attack her for being tied to Trek bicycle. Now, to me, that's like Kleenex. I mean, virtually everybody who's got a bike in Wisconsin owns a Trek. It's like an iconic Wisconsin brand, yet somehow because Mary Burke is tied to the Trek name, it's now evil. Well, why? I have a Trek bike.
I have one.
Actually, I have two Trek bikes.
Well, maybe if she wins, I'll have to sell it.
I have a Giant bicycle, but then I found out Trek bought Giant, too, so I guess that's theirs, too.
I think that's not what's going to hinge.
How many bikes do you have, Joe?
Three bikes.
Okay.
That's not what's going to hinge on this election. I think she has her problems have nothing to do with Doyle. I think her problems is name recognition statewide, creating a constituency around her. Walker, for better or for worse, whatever, everybody knows his name across the state. He has a group of people that have twice stepped forward for him, first in the election, second in the recall. They will be mobilized. I think her struggle has nothing to do with Doyle. It has to do with fundraising, name recognition, all the classic things that happens when a newcomer steps into politics.
I think she has a fantastic chance of winning, and I'm not saying this just to do the Democratic stroke. I mean, I look at it, and every poll I've ever seen, Scott Walker gets about 47%, never gets to 50. And as an unknown person, Mary Burke in the last Marquette poll was 47-45. She has shown prodigious fundraising already. She raised $1.838 million in 3 months. She has resources of her own.
It's all that outside big labor union money.
Wait, Scott Walker killed all the big labor unions, remember? You know, that other unnecessary thing he had to do just because he's a bitter guy, I guess. But all of that stuff tells me, and she's a female, and I think, and I'll tell you, I think women candidates are good candidates. And I think she's got a lot of things going for her. Yes, her name recognition is relatively low. That also can be a plus because she doesn't have the baggage that a Scott Walker has, for example.
She's got another problem. She's Dane County. I want you to think a bit about how many Dane County politicians, either Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter, have leveraged a Dane County position to the state. It's very hard.
Jim Doyle, Tony Earl, Gaylord Nelson, Bill Proxmire.
Really?
Yeah, they're all from Madison.
But in recent years, it's been hard to do.
Well, Jim Doyle was the last governor. I mean, before Scott.
Well,
Walker.
But Doyle.
It's as Madison as there is.
Doyle had a long period in state.
Tammy Baldwin.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess a lot of them.
John relents.
What?
Did you just relent?
I relent.
Okay.
I relent.
Let's take a call from...
The list is formidable.
Let's take a call from Tom in Wanakee.
Well, just regarding the tax refund, I recall... The first one I recall was shortly after Lee Dreyfus took office. And it seems to be... My recollection is every time they give back 100 or 200 bucks, the economy shortly after... And not because of the rebate, but it just goes down. It goes in the tank. And then we're really stuck with no extra money, no rainy day fund or whatever you want to call it. That's just my comment.
Tom, you're speaking my speech. I just think it's better to pay off your debt. This is a conservative approach to family financing. You put some money in the bank for the rainy day, you pay down your debts, and then you see if the following year and the year after that produces surpluses, then you can look at tax cuts. But to every time you get a little blurb in the funding coffers doesn't mean you immediately respond with tax cuts. That's my approach. I'm sorry, I'm a conservative.
Both Tom and John are right. I mean, if we'd actually use this money to actually put in a rainy day fund or get rid of accounting gimmicks, which is the same effect, the next budget would be the first one since the 90s where we have been able to budget normally. What a concept. But no, we're going to give it all away and start $825 million in the hole again. I bought a bowling ball with Lee Dreyfus's $40 I got from him, too.
I don't even remember what I did with
it. It was a Columbia Yellow Dot 300. It's kind of like your first bike.
Didn't George Bush send everybody $50?
Yeah, Tommy Thompson did $300.
Let's talk next to Dave in Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. Well, George Bush sent several checks of $500. He used the same line that Governor Walker used, that the government took too much of your money and you deserve a refund, you know. That. And we got to remember, tax breaks don't create jobs. Tax breaks didn't create jobs under George Bush. As a matter of fact, tax breaks made jobs go away. Tax increases under Clinton, we had a bunch of jobs that were created. And I think that Governor Walker is afraid of having a surplus because he may have to actually use it to maybe put some money in Badger Care or Medicare or put it into infrastructure, actually creating some jobs so these people can get out and pay taxes themselves. And I think that would probably generate more money in the long run than trying to give me, you know, $4 a month, which is what, a can of food a week? That money is just being thrown away.
Thanks, Dave. What about that? Do lower taxes equate lower job creation?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with Dave on that. There's two schools of economics. The tax cuts do promote job growth. And the theory is if people have more money in their hands, they do two things. At the upper end, they invest it. At the lower end, they spend it. Both are stimulators for economic growth. Another argument is unless the tax cuts are big, really, really big, a substantial cut in the marginal rate, that sort of thing doesn't happen. The money trickles out there and it just kind of disappears in another six-pack of beer. The people, if you get $50 or $100, you don't offer, that doesn't alter your investment or your consumption patterns. A guy who lives on Maple Bluff who's pulling down six figures, if he gets $150, he won't even know it. That's a dinner at the club, you know. So the problem with there is a body of theory that says tax cuts can stimulate economies, and I believe that's true. But the cuts have to be so big that they damage government.
Once again, John, you're right. And the problem with this is a trickle cut. It's just a little, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there. Nobody will even know they got it. The problem that I see that's going on with this governor and this legislature, and frankly, the House of Representatives, is they talk about we got to cut taxes to grow the economy, to put money, and the argument is to put money in hard-earned, you know, people's pockets. Yet here was Scott Walker yesterday steadfastly calling an increase in the minimum wage, which put more money in poor people's pockets, as a political gimmick. The same governor that takes 80,000 people, poor people, off of Medicaid, Badger Care, and tells them to go sign up for the federal exchanges. You can't have it both ways. And the hypocrisy at times that I see on this is terrible. Now, the last point is we've been starving infrastructure in this state. Schools. Public schools have lost about $1.3 billion in the last 2 years. They did not fare very well in the last 2 years of the Doyle administration because of the recession. The university system has lost about $250 million in the last 4 years. The technical colleges have lost 30%. All these different things, we have a $350 million shortfall in our transportation fund. All these things are hard to fix once they get too far down. And it takes a while before your educational system starts to crumble. But if you don't continue to understand that for 60 years we became the greatest country in the world because we put money into education, we put money into transportation, and it was Dwight Eisenhower who created the highway system, we're guaranteed to have failure, but it might take 15 years. And then what do we do when all the water and sewer systems crumble, the roads crumble, the bridges crumble, and our school systems
crumble? And the zombies come.
And the zombies, well, they're everywhere. Have you seen AMC?
Well, I don't know where to start on this, Joe. Just a quick comment on the minimum wage. I've been thinking a lot. I was raised in a family where my mother was a hardcore, old-fashioned FDR Democrat, believed strongly in the minimum wage. I was brought up with that mantra. I've been trying to think that through right now and just kind of parse that. I'm not so sure. I do understand the argument that it does help people, particularly in sort of low-level retail. It's primarily the spot where it helps, people working at McDonald's. I do think it's necessary, if you are going to increase the minimum wage, you have to remember that nothing is free. That money will come from somewhere, and it will come from the employer. The employer then has two choices. They can pass that on to consumers, and sometimes if you're McDonald's, you can get away with that because you're big and you can add another 5 cents to every hamburger, and you don't feel it, and it gets passed on to the worker. That's fine. If you're a small mom-and-pop place on State Street, you're a small restaurant, you're a brick-and-mortar shop that's selling something and you're trying to compete against the Internet, it will hurt you. It will hurt you because there's no way to pass that on. So then you have to make some choices about employment. And that's what people worry about. It may actually lead you to lay off one of your people. And so you have to make a tough choice. Mary gets to work. She gets to work for more. But Alice can't come to work anymore. And I'm going to work Mary harder because I have to pay her more now. So it has to be, your heart may go out to an increase in the minimum wage. What's the old saying from Churchill? If you're young and you're not liberal, you have no heart. And if you're older and you're not conservative, you have no brain.
Well, that's one of the few times Churchill was wrong. And the last quick point I would just make is, somebody who works in this society, who works full-time and plays by the rules, ought to be able to live above the poverty level. And increasing the minimum wage to, say, $10 an hour would allow that to happen.
I just said why that could not, that could turn out to be counterproductive.
Let's try it and see.
We are listening to The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. Our guests this week are John Sharpless, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Joe Winicky, former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. We've been reflecting on the State of the State address. We'll move on to some other issues as well before the end of the hour, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're talking this week with John Sharpless, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Joe Winicky, a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. The state Democrats responded to the State of the State address this week by criticizing progress on creating jobs, noting the most recent statistics that placed the state 37th in the nation, down from 11th for private sector job growth. Are we in a good shape for jobs, John Sharpless?
Well, I've got a master's in statistics. What's the old line? Figures don't lie, but liars can figure. It depends on the numbers you use. We've got more jobs in this state than we had when Walker came in. There's no doubt about that. Whether or not it's his policies that generated those or an increase in the national economy generally, that's just one of the rituals of politics. If things go up, you get credit for the improvement. If things go down, people blame you for them. He is not going to reach the goal he promised. That's just quite evident. I can't believe he promised that many. What was it, Joe?
250
million?
1,000.
250 million.
250 million. We'll get 5.6 million in the state.
I just don't think he'll meet that goal. There is no doubt there are more people working in the state than when he came in.
Joe?
The problem the governor has, one, is he should have realized after the first year or year and a half that there was no way, God's green earth, he could get to that number, and he should have started backing away from it. But he's stubborn, and he keeps going on this number like it's going to happen still. Well, he's got like 10 months left in his term, and he's at about 90,000 jobs, so he's got to go. He's at 100, so I'm going to take away 10 because I doubt that number's real. But even there, he'd be at his own numbers. Mm-hmm. He's at 40% of the way. We are 37th to 39th in the national job numbers. But the one that scares me the most is we're 48th in new business and new job creation in this country. So we're second to last in the new growth stuff. And that's what really should make people nervous. We're not a good state when it comes to entrepreneurial money, you know, angel investing, things like that. Our manufacturing sector has taken a hit, and most of the jobs that are coming in are in that service sector. They are at the McDonald's and Burger Kings and stuff. And, you know, so you create a job, but it pays $7.25 an hour without bennies.
But I think this is a national problem.
It is.
I think America is facing, my conservative friends are going to be a little concerned about whether or not I'm going left on them. I'm going to go into a little rant here about the most serious problem in America right now, and it's income distribution. And I know it's been a rallying cry for Democrats for about a decade, and Republicans hadn't listened to it. I want all my Republican friends to take a close, honest look to the maldistribution of wealth and income in this country. It's destroying America. If people don't have faith that they can make it, and that's what's happening here, if they become disgruntled, they eventually will become angry, and you will have an angry America, and we cannot afford that. So the major problem we face, and it's not all taxes and spending and public policy. It has to do with structural changes in our economy, robotics. So many industries now are highly technical. The kinds of people they hire are not the kinds of people who will ever work there, the McDonald's people. I don't know what's going to come of that, and I see that as a very sad story for the future of America.
John, quickly on that. You know, but every once in a while you see an American success story, and take the auto industry. Because I agree with everything you just said. But the auto industry almost died, right? And it's completely roboticized now. Yet in the last 2 years, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler have added somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 or 80,000 new good-paying jobs because they've recovered from that.
Yeah, but Janesville's still closed.
It isn't coming back, unfortunately. I wish it would. I mean, they had a great workplace.
They closed factories all over the country because what they wanted is move production into their high-tech factories.
Unfortunately, that one was in Mexico.
We've got a few other issues to get to before the end of the hour. And first, I want to offer up the Week in Review quiz question, which does pertain to the State of the State address on Wednesday. Governor Walker highlighted many of the state's agricultural resources, including one that constitutes 95% of American exports of this crop to China. It is also the subject of a new international trade agreement. We ask our listeners, what crop is he talking about? If you know the answer, you can call into the Week in Review quiz at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email in your guests at talk@wpr.org, and we'll pick a name at random out of our correct guessers, and we'll announce that winner and the answer later this hour. Joe Winicky, John Sharpless, the Senate approved more than a dozen bills expanding resources available for mental health treatment in the state. Governor Walker said he will sign these bills, which add grants for law enforcement intervention efforts, respite centers, and psychiatrists for underserved areas. Is this a good example of bipartisanship in the state, Joe Winicky?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's modest, but the main reason I think the Republicans are pushing it is it's a way to counteract any attempt to deal with guns, which will get John into his gun stuff.
You're right. The mantra for gun owners has been improved mental health.
Yeah.
But we can leave that aside. If you want to debate guns, I don't want to.
I just thought I'd get under your skin a little.
You guys are like brothers, I have to say.
Do away with the Second Amendment.
Okay. I didn't mean that, actually.
So I think this has been a long time coming. I don't think there's – setting aside the debate over guns, I think America has come to some agreement that there are larger social implications. That this is one of those problems where improving the individual lives of people and caring for people who are challenged in terms of mental problems – that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But it turns out it's also a social good thing, mm-hmm. because troubled people can be troubling in the society as a whole. And so I really favor this bill. I think it's it could have gone further. In fact, some of that surplus could have gone into expanding this program that we collectively agree that needs to be done.
And, you know, there's another area that I think will be bipartisan, and it relates to heroin abuse. And in this case, I think one of the main reasons happens to be that one of the leaders in the legislature has a daughter that got caught up in this terrible trap. But whatever the reason, if we can get people of goodwill to come together to fix it or try to fix it, these are like the only two things I can think of in the whole darn state government that they've done on a bipartisan basis.
I have one concern as a libertarian, and that is whenever we overreach in terms of defining mental illness and we constrain people who are simply kooky. They're difficult. They don't fit in. They make us uncomfortable. And but they're not crazy. They're just troublesome. They're just people we don't like. And I'm always concerned that we use the power of the state to restrain them, to put them in institutions, to limit their freedom. That bothers me.
It's only been 40 to 50 years since we used to basically put them all away. And then we opened up our society, and it's a much better society for it. But occasionally you run into problems. And I think what you're saying is don't use a hammer when you could use a chisel. Or use
I don't even know how to follow that analogy, no. Joe. So
why use a hammer when you could do a precision?
Oh, I see. Okay. You're not going to restrain them with a hammer, are
you? No, I'm actually the opposite way on that.
Okay.
So if bipartisanship can be achieved over something like mental illness, something that we can all come together around in treating, what can we learn from that experience and apply to some of these other more divisive issues that we can't seem to find bipartisanship on? I'll take whoever wants to take that.
Well, I just think that there are certain issue areas which bring us together. They just do. People troubled with mental illness deserve, if you're a Republican, they deserve our charity. If you're a Democrat, they deserve as an essential social right. However, your philosophy of why they deserve it, we come together about that group of people needs to be cared for by the larger community. I think the division comes more often in areas where the recipient of public support on the two sides is viewed differently. Am I not being very clear on this, am I?
Well, I wasn't very clear on the last one, so okay. It's even.
And there's some Joe hit it on the head. Certainly among gun owners, there has been one of the responses to further gun control has been better mental health. So that brings in a group of people who normally would probably not be not indifferent but not enthusiastic. So that brings in that group. I'm frankly less sanguine about that. I shouldn't use professor language, should I?
It's public radio.
Okay. I'm less sanguine about that. I'm not so sure. You can pour a lot of money into mental health and you'll still have people do really horrible, violent things. That's just that's gone on ever since the Old Testament when Cain killed Abel.
You know, John, when we get out of this 40-below weather stuff and you get back to your country farm, you'll forget all about those sanguines and stuff and get back to those real words. The only way you're going to get true bipartisanship back in this society at the state and national level is you've got to take the money out of politics. It's killing us.
The reason there's money in politics is that government's up to its rear end in every aspect of our life. That's why there's money in politics.
Well, now that Citizens United has come about, the candidates usually finish last in spending to some nebulous interest group with a nice name that they don't even know who's attacking them. I thought we had a right to know our accusers in this society.
Wow. So here's the website I've been fantasizing about. Bribe your legislator. You go to this website and you cut out the middle group, the PACs, and you can put in your credit card and you can directly bribe your legislator, and your legislator can introduce a bill that would personally affect you. What do you think, Joe?
I think Joel Clefish did that.
we got a shush sign. They can't. I'm sorry. From John. Okay, one last thing before we have to wrap. In a speech on Wednesday morning at the annual State Education Convention, State Superintendent Tony Evers defended the Common Core educational standards, which have been under fire in recent months. Evers said the standards were already raising expectations in schools across the state. John Sharpless, do you think this criticism of Common Core is merited?
I'm going to back off on this question. I've sort of followed this issue. I'm not really sure what the Common Core is. I would have to take a look at it. It struck me as an experiment that hasn't played out yet. I don't know why there's been this reaction to it. I don't think really bad things have happened. It would seem to me, to the extent that I understand what the Common Core is, and I'm not fully versed on it, we should give it a couple of years to see how it works.
I think you're going to have to give it a decade or more. I mean, basically, it is what it sounds like. I mean, we're trying to create a national set of core standards to guarantee that everybody has that basic education. And you can't. The reason this is being attacked is this is something that the Tea Party has latched onto, and it's scaring more conservative members of the Republican Party, more of the mainstream moderate members that are still around that haven't been beaten primaries. are more willing to let this happen. And, I mean, as long as there's like a Luther Olson, for example, as chair of the Senate Education Committee, I think Common Core is going to be here for a while. But this attack is political in its nature. It's not policy in its nature.
We heard in the news this morning that Democratic State Representative Melissa Sargent says she'll introduce a bill that would fully legalize marijuana in Wisconsin. Does that bill see a future, and should it, in your mind? I'll start with you, Joe Winicky.
Well, there's a difference between will it and should it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's not going anywhere in this Republican House and Senate and this governor. I think we should move towards medical marijuana first, see how that plays in the state, and if 5 or 10 years from now, if the winds blow in society as it seems to be on gay marriage today, maybe at that point we look at that too. But we can't even get medical marijuana in this state, which has a legitimate good purpose.
Actually, John? I think I might be wrong on this. I think there's a bill coming through that would actually potentially increase the penalties.
Yes, there is.
For marijuana use, there's been some concern. And I don't know where this is being voiced, that local police are cracking down on marijuana, and they issue the tickets, and these local prosecutors, in my mind, quite legitimately don't follow through on them because it's a waste of money. When I ran for Congress...
Guess which one's going to pass, John?
When I ran for Congress in 98, I'm a libertarian type. I think that marijuana should be legal and it should be taxed. You buy it at liquor stores. There should be government standards for its quality. There should be very careful limits on its use in terms of minors, on driving cars, operating heavy equipment. All the rules we have in place for alcohol should be there for marijuana. I'm not a weed guy. I'd like to sit with my Jack Daniels on the porch and watch the sunset with my shotgun on my lap waiting for the zombies. But if somebody wants to sit there with a joint, that's fine with me.
You know, John, I've never smoked a joint in my life, and I say that in all truth. But, you know, we've got two opportunities to see how this is going to work in Colorado and Washington. Let's see how it works. If it works there, let's bring it here.
And when was the last time you saw a headline that said, pothead kills five?
Zero.
Well, it's time to reveal our answer in this Week in Review quiz. We asked, in the State of the State Address Wednesday, Governor Walker highlighted many of the state's agricultural resources, including one that constitutes 95% of American exports of that crop to China. We don't have time to have Governor Walker give us the answer himself. Do you know it, Joe?
I'm assuming it's ginseng.
I'm assuming it's hemp.
It is actually ginseng. The governor praised Wisconsin's agricultural crops, including corn, cranberries, and ginseng.
So he's pushing an aphrodisiac to China. I love this guy.
He signed an agreement in April that said it was worth $150 to $200 million. Two members of the Wisconsin Ginseng Board were also present for the State of the State address. Thank you guys so much for joining us today on the Week in Review. John Sharpless is a history professor at the UW-Madison, and Joe Winicky is a former state legislator and former chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing the hour and Robin Cherry for on-air producing. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.